Marilyn Fan and I, my name's Paul Hain, are going to engage in a dialogue for a while. And as soon as we get the issue settled, you can throw in your two bits worth. What you're supposed to be doing while I'm introducing the subject is reading this sheet of paper, which is going to substitute for a long speech that I would otherwise make. Last week, in a session here, I said essentially this. I argued this position, and Marilyn didn't agree. We've had some long conversations since, and I think our disagreements are productive. I'm not even sure altogether where we disagree. But I just want to say, I hope you will read this. Don't listen to me now. Just read it. What I am trying to do here is state something that I believe to be true, not on the basis of my reading of the Bible. I don't derive this from Christian theology. This is not a defense of Luther's two-kingdom concept, which I'm abandoning. I'm not sure I want to defend it. I just suggest that maybe what I'm trying to get at is what Luther was trying to take account of when he presented his doctrine of the concept of the two kingdoms. I am convinced simply that we are inevitably dependent upon systems of social cooperation that cannot function if we try to live within them in accord with the kind of ethical rules that most of us think are the only ethical rules, what I call the ethical rules of face-to-face society. I think that there is nothing immoral or unchristian or wrong or undesirable about living in accord with the much more limited and I suppose much less inspiring ethics of the impersonal society. So in a way, I am asserting that there are at least two systems of ethics that the Christian, and almost everyone else, can and should indeed use. The ethics of the impersonal society and the ethics of the face-to-face society. And I've tried to describe that here, and you will recognize the jargon as the jargon that economists use, because that's the kind of beast I turned out to be. But so I'm not going to say any more. You have read this. You have been offended or converted or whatever. And now I'm going to let Marilyn Fenn introduce herself. You tell them what they need to know about you or what you're willing to reveal.
My name is Marilyn Fenn, and I work here as the registrar, and I've been here a couple years. After I leave here, I plan to go to Iowa and be a peace educator on a state university campus. And much of what I hope to be discussing with students will be the kingdom of God, the ethics of the kingdom, and helping them and myself question just how normative Jesus is for my life, for their life, whether Jesus is normative on a social and a political scale, and calling groups of Christians into discussion, passionate discussion, of where Jesus is Lord. I think it relates strongly with what Paul and I will discuss, trying to figure out, are there two ethical systems? Is there one ethical system for a Christian person? And after we finish, as he said, after we settle the issue, then we'd like you to pipe in. Obviously, we won't settle the issue. Has everyone had a chance to read through Paul's statement? Raise your hand if you haven't, if you'd like a minute or two. Okay, I think it'd be helpful if you just could read that first. Assuming everyone's just about there, I'll refer to parts of the statement, not picking it apart, but just so that we have some common ground on which to see what I'm reacting to. John Schramm, in his session this morning, stated Bonhoeffer's question once again, who is Christ? And that is a question in every age, and that Christians must struggle with their answer to that question. And Paul's statement and his session last week brought that question up within me very strongly once again. And we have had a very fruitful dialogue going for a week off and on. Who is Jesus Christ and what does it mean to follow him? I think in Paul's statement, he makes a rational claim, a very logical claim, and an intelligent claim that we do all live in large systems, not just one system, but different kinds of systems, interlocking networks by which we benefit and to which we contribute. I am not out to deny that reality. I think that is reality. It's a given. In dividing, however, our lives into a personal sphere where we relate with people on a face-to-face basis and into an impersonal social sphere where we do not relate to people, all the people who live with the consequences of our behavior, it's at this point that I think we have to ask that question, what does it mean to follow Jesus? Is there a normative way of understanding reality that comes out of the New Testament, which advocates that we see life in this way, or which would encourage us to see life more holistically? And based upon my understanding of the biblical teaching of reality and how we experience the world, I would say that there is no division between the personal and the impersonal, that they are part of a whole, and that we as Christians use one set of ethics, best described, not prescribed, not dictated to us, but described in the Beatitudes found in Luke and Matthew, and that these Beatitudes are not only for guidelines for how we will relate to people on a one-to-one basis, but how we are also to relate on a larger, less personal, I won't say impersonal, less personal basis. First, I'd like to say that my understanding of the New Testament is that Jesus is first and foremost a socially and politically relevant figure. He is not first and foremost a person with whom I relate on a one-to-one basis, or whose major goal on earth was to establish personal relationships among himself and individuals. I'd like to say that I don't believe that Jesus operated on the self-interest ethic that is described in the statement. I think that the New Testament witness is that Jesus went beyond self-interest in his dealings with the large networks and systems of his day. When he encountered the Jewish authorities and the Roman authorities, I think that he rejected the natural, the sensible, the rational ways of behaving, and that he chose to act in costly self-love. Costly love of other, setting aside his self-interest as the ultimate priority in his dealings with other people, and even in his understanding of economics. I think that in Jesus' first sermon at Nazareth, when he stood in the synagogue in his good old hometown and stated what he was going to have at the center of his ministry and what the kingdom he was advocating was about, he made statements about setting the oppressed free, debts being forgiven, that this was the acceptable year of the Lord, which in the Old Testament is another way of saying this is Jubilee year. This is the year where we forgive debts, where we redistribute goods, where those who have lost their land due to economic circumstances, it goes back to original landowners. So there was a concrete economic and political nature to what Jesus was advocating, I say, from the beginning of his ministry to his death on the cross. And that this is not just normative for Jesus' time, not just relevant to that social, political, economic reality, but that is equally relevant to our experience of reality also. Jesus was given political titles. I don't think that's a mistake. I think that that is part of the way that the New Testament writers were expressing the fact that Jesus was politically relevant, was seen as a political, social figure, and that we cannot reduce his impact on our life or the society of his time to his healing of individuals or to his personal love of people that he encountered on a face-to-face basis. Messiah, King, Lord, Christ, the Anointed, those are the titles given Jesus rather than simply friend, confidant, buddy, comforter. There could have been a very different set of words used to describe Jesus, and I think the titles are very significant in our concept of who Jesus was and is and what he was really doing here on earth. I ask myself that often. What in the world was Jesus doing here on earth? I think a central question then to go back is how normative is this Jesus? I assert that the very nature of the gospel is very social and very political. Not in the unredeemed sense of plain politics, but in the redeemed sense of living by the Beatitudes, both in our personal and in our social spheres.
Well, problem is that I find myself very much sympathy with what Marilyn said. I have recently read John Howard Yoder's Politics of Jesus, a book which I avoided reading for a long time because I didn't like the title. I mistakenly thought that this was another one of these books put out by the National Council of Churches to tell me that I've got to be in favor of a minimum wage law if I want to be a Christian. Well, it's not that at all. I think John Howard Yoder's book, His Politics of Jesus, and I never refer to this because I know, talking to Marilyn, she's been deeply influenced by this book. And I think it's a marvelous book. It's very disturbing to me, and I think in the right way. And yet I find myself able to assent to everything Yoder says and not withdraw one jot or tittle of what I have said on this page. That's the problem. And I don't know how to get at that. I've jotted down three things that I think are important when Marilyn was talking. Three propositions that seem to me true and important to recognize. One is that there are few Christians in the world. If the world is to be maintained, it will be maintained through the efforts of lots of people who are not Christians. I think there is some value in maintaining the world. Not all parts of it, but the second thing, maybe even more important, is that even if we were all Christians of the finest type, there would still be a need for the ethics of the impersonal society. I think this is the fundamental contention, and I don't know whether we can get at that. But I believe that Jesus did play by the ethics of the impersonal society at times. I cannot conceive how he could have lived and traveled around and eaten if he hadn't. The third thing I want to say, there may come a time when we as Christians are called to confront an impersonal system, some particular impersonal system, and refuse to abide by its rules because we have decided that this particular system is not worth preserving. Or though it has ministered to the needs of people in some fashion, it is now, I hate to use this word demonic, but a lot of these people, we decide it's demonic, but its goodness is outweighed by its badness, that we are called at this point to take the risk of bringing down the whole structure rather than participate in this structure, which is now producing results that are intolerable. I think one area in which many Christians, whom I respect, have made this decision is the realm of nuclear armaments and participation in the whole system of national foreign policy. There are Christians who have rejected realpolitik and have asserted, for complex reasons having to do with their understanding of who Jesus is in the world and their own history, and I think their own social analysis too, some estimate, I would hope, some estimate that they make of the probability that they will bear an effective witness. I don't want to say that you must be effective to be faithful. I think it's a mistake to suppose that you have to be yourself. You have to be ready fully to accept the consequences of all your actions. I don't think that's true. I think the Christian is called to act sometimes with courage and recklessness and foolhardiness. So I grant all of these things. Nonetheless, here's what I've come down to. I tried to put it in the second last paragraph. I suggest an analogy of driving in traffic and then refer to a business decision maker. I think that, I know that many people in business today, especially the executive officers of corporations that are in the public eye, or any kind of business firm that gets in the public eye, it doesn't have to be large, are being admonished on many sides to pursue social responsibility, to manage their firms in ways that are socially responsible. And when they're asked what this means, it means, well, it turns out that they're provided with all sorts of criteria that I submit are simply inappropriate for them to use. They are criteria that are only appropriate in a face-to-face society. That if they try to do all of these good, if they try to reduce racism and eliminate sexism and take care of their community and keep wages high and keep benefits, keep quality products and maintain relationships with suppliers and support the local community, and on and on and on, all these things, that what is happening is that these executives are being asked to make decisions that they are, A, incompetent to make, and two, they should not really be allowed to make. They are arrogant decisions. I do not want business decision makers to be the managers of society, the arbiters among all of the conflicting demands that are placed upon the executive of a business firm. I believe that it is ethical and responsible and humble and effective for a business decision maker to focus on maximizing net revenue of that firm, always within the accepted rules of the game, and then of course also to live his personal life. That means people with whom he or she comes in contact in the business. They're the ethics of the personal society. Apply once again. If you get to know your secretary, if you're a business executive and you get to know your secretary well enough, and I think you should get to know your secretary well enough, I think it's wrong. I think it's a mistake and it's a perversion and all of that for executives to suppose, or people at work to suppose, that they should have only impersonal relationships with the people at work. But there are problems with that. But anyway, Ben, I certainly am not saying that when you go to work, then the ethics of the face-to-face society are all forgotten. They're not. I'm saying when you are participating in this impersonal realm, as you are doing when you drive your car in traffic, then you've got to obey those rules. If you don't, the system will break down. No one will be well served. I think you will be guilty of claiming for yourself a power that you don't have. Not a knowledge that you don't have. It's knowledge that seems to me to be the fundamental problem.
Within your last statement, I hear a lack of an awareness of, or an acknowledgement of, social moral responsibility, or group or corporate moral responsibility. I think that within Western Christianity, there has been a tremendous trend, and I'll say since the 3rd century, to view Christianity as being operative within the personal realm, but not within the social and the group realm. And that this is manifest very much in the brand of capitalism which has arisen in the West, and a system of which we are all a part, both benefactors, beneficiaries, and I would also say victims. The knowledge problem is a tremendous problem, and I would not say that any corporate executive has adequate or sufficient knowledge to make decisions weighing moral values, moral consequences, that are going to affect all sorts of people who they do not know. I don't believe that any executive can hold all of that knowledge in their mind or even around a boardroom table. That is one of the fundamental problems I see with that system. Rather than accepting that system and its avowed assumption that it is in existence to make profit, and not that that would all be negative, but that is the reason why businesses are in business, that I believe that there are all sorts of very personal consequences of the decisions of a corporate executive, consequences within the huge systems that we have that are very personal for the people who experience those consequences, and that to set aside all those moral obligations because they are ambiguous, because it's difficult to see where all the connections are, is to simply deny the problem rather than to face what huge systems, what kinds of moral binds huge impersonal systems can get us into.
Will, is the issue joined? Are you, what say you?
Paul, when you made a statement earlier about as individuals under the influence of various social systems, you said, though we have to participate in them, we do at times declare some of them void and actually bankrupt, and in so doing, either pull ourselves out or try to change or replace them. What values or criteria are used to evaluate the bankruptcy of a social system? Are those values and criteria personal or impersonal? Are they of two separate sources within the person? Or is the impersonal quite naturally, obviously affected by the personal values?
That's a good question, a hard one. I've never thought about it. In my own experience, I've never been quite sure why I was doing it when I did it. It's a sense that this stinks. if these are the rules of the game that I got to play by, I don't want to play. You know that. Why? I don't know. I always want to admit that when I withdraw from a system, there may be a lot of ego involved in it. I may just be finding that it's not stroking me in the right place. But you're asking, in my more responsible moments, when I come to myself and try to make that decision, I'm not sure, Jim, what it is. I don't think that I could participate heartily and happily in a system if I thought that that system did not produce lots of benefits for people, benefits that far outweighed the incidental costs. So the market system, the capitalist system, if you will, is one in which I participate for that reason. I do not think that it does, there's a lot of harm associated with it, but there's a lot of harm associated with human interaction, and that I don't know how to reduce or relieve. One of the reasons that I support the capitalist system is that it seems to me to set some very important and effective checks on human arrogance and pretension, and that it minimizes the amount of evil in the world. When I have rebelled against systems, I've rebelled against small ones. University systems. Refuse to participate in
them. What I'm trying to get at is that nonetheless a system is a system, if you're going to use that term, or else you should break it down and use different terms. But so far we're using one. And what I'm trying to point out is that I think that there is a far greater interface between the personal ethics and the impersonal ethics in regards to evolving or replacing social systems than either you want to admit or that you recognize or simply that I think. And that may be the case. But what I'm trying to say is that trying to make this clear by what you just said. You said, this stinks. Why did you say this stinks? It occurs to me that you did so from a personal, gut level impression. And it seems to me you would probably say that to another person in confidence or in dialogue. And what I'm trying to get across is that the personal ethic may affect the impersonal to a far greater degree than either we realize its potential, simply because perhaps it hasn't so far. And what I'm trying to, what I'd like to believe is that social systems are more evolutionary and not necessarily static, which brings you back then human nature and the arrogance of human beings, and whether that is necessary. And I think what Marilyn is, when it comes down to that, I think what Marilyn is probably saying is I have a greater faith in potential or potential transformation of human beings through grace and belief in Christ. Yeah, that's hard to say.
That may be. But I just thought of one criterion, if I may, that when a system, when an impersonal system, by which I mean a system in which it's assumed that people will pursue their own interests, but because of the operative rules of the game, this will lead to roughly the interest of everybody. The public interest will emerge. When I find that's not happening because the rules of the game are defective, that's one reason I may withdraw. And generally, when I find that not happening, it's because I find that people are being treated not impersonally, but in an inhumane way. When I find that the rules of the game lead to inhumane treatment. You see, if I found that it was necessary for employers to treat employees or for employees to treat employers in a dehumanized way, they could not, when they encountered them, regard them as human beings, then I would find the system unsatisfactory.
Well, I have a point of mine that I'd like to make, and I have a question for Marilyn. First of all, I see the personal side of, let's say, the human corporation, so to speak, as setting the standards of the other system. So that if you have enough people who don't like the system will change in and of itself, because the people make the system, and in that way, everybody's personal system interacts with the impersonal system on a minute scale as an individual, but as corporate humanity on the full scale. So I don't see that as really a major problem. But what I have question I have from Marilyn is that if you remove or if you change and say, okay, everybody, it should be done on the personal system and the personal system should rule, not the impersonal, how do you fit the corporate, maybe I'm missing something here, but what do you give this corporate executive, what rationalization do you give him in order to make his decisions. If he can't use the, if he has to use a personal all the time, from the Christian standpoint, if he can't use that, what does he use to make his decisions? Because I believe in the straight capitalist system, supply and demand, and profit and all this kind of stuff within the rules, just pretty much like Paul. The thing about it is I don't believe that the government should interfere with it either. And I would have let Lockheed and Chrysler go down the tubes if it was at any cost to the taxpayers, because they could not exist because of the corporate decisions they had made. They were in trouble. A lot of people would have been hurt, but the greater good would have been served, the way I see it.
Can I respond to your question by going back and responding to your response? You said that you felt that on a corporate level, when you're dealing in a large impersonal system, that it is the personal ethics, the personal values of the individuals involved in that system, which will affect the way that that body then operates.
Yes.
Okay. I think that that is part of what I perceive as being an illusion. I do not believe that there is this huge chasm between the personal and the impersonal. I see them as being very intermingled, and that oftentimes we can't separate out the two. In listening to your theory about how the ethics, personal ethics, would influence corporate ethics, I think we oftentimes, as Paul's statement states, we set aside our personal face-to-face values because we say now we're operating in the impersonal sphere. These do not apply. We cannot see all the personal connections, the personal ramifications of our decisions in this large system, so we must simply choose one operative mode, and that is, in the system of capitalism, profit. I'd like to give an example of where I think personally moral people involved in a large impersonal system make grossly immoral decisions as a body, as a corporate business body. I'd like to take the example of Dole Pineapple, who operated farms and factories, canning plants in Hawaii. When it became financially difficult to make a profit in Hawaii due to the advent of higher minimum wage, they decided, or the Dole Corporation decided, to leave Hawaii and to invest in the Philippines. Under President Marcos, there was a law passed in that legislative system, I guess I'll say, which declared that all landholders had to come and lay legal claim to their ground, which their families perhaps had owned for centuries, but they now had to have that surveyed, and they had to go to the nearest, the equivalent of a county seat, and register that. Many of the Filipino landowners were small landholders. They could not read, they could not see the statements, you know, declaring that this had to be done legally if they were to keep their land. What happened was that then whichever land plots were not legally claimed could be purchased from the government. Dole Pineapple purchased vast acreage, hectares, in the Philippines, and small farmers who had their families been farming in the Philippines for centuries found themselves being literally bulldozed off their own property, and their homes being leveled. And I do not believe it was the personal ethical decision of people sitting on the board of Dole Pineapple who decided they were going to oppress the Philippine peasantry. But because I do not think that they took seriously the cultural ramifications of their entry into the Philippine system, I do not believe they looked seriously at the human rights stance of the Marcos government,
I believe there was a very strong case of social sin right there. And that oftentimes within the capitalist system, when we set aside our personal values because we cannot, I agree, it's difficult to see all the ramifications of decisions on that huge a scale, but we set them aside saying what we're in business for is to make a profit, that we deny the very personal consequences of our supposedly impersonal ethical decision-making process.
Do you assert that this example is either the norm, might be the norm. Do you assert that it's the norm for a business operation?
I believe on the transnational level that is not uncommon.
Do you feel that in spite of the fact that maybe many landowners lost their land, that perhaps the greater good might have been served anyway by providing industry in the Philippines, and because the best way to some people are going to get hurt no matter what happens.
Well, they were self-sufficient farmers before this happened. They were feeding their own populations. Now many of them, there are severe hunger problems. There's tremendous political oppression in the Philippines. I don't believe that in all the greater good to serve.
Can I get into this one? I think, first of all, I always dislike it when we get off into international problems where we know even less than we do about domestic ones. I think it's always nice to solve simple problems first and then move to the difficult ones. But in regard to the Dole pineapple case, I would say that the problem here, assuming that Marilyn has correctly described it, is an unjust redistribution of land that occurred. Now, what do I mean by an unjust redistribution of land? An unjust redistribution of land is one that is not in accord with the accepted principles of law and justice, which I happen to think that people can roughly agree on. Now, it sounds very much to me as if the redistribution of land that was effected here with the connivance, cooperation at the instance of the Philippine government, if Dole Pineapple understood what was happening here and nonetheless sought this unjust legislation, then I believe their executives acted wrongly.
I would agree.
And I suspect that in this case the real problem means the one where the lever of change has to be grasped is probably the political structure of the Philippines. Now you get into then a complex problem that if you cooperate with them you are shoring it up, and that's one reason I like to stay out of there, because what I also agree with what you said, a great deal of foreign investment made by the new bad term used to be multinational, now it's transnational corporations. I'm one of those who thinks a lot of that has been good, and I hate to see us now using transnational corporations as a general whipping boy. But
I worked for one of these corporations, and if it wasn't for the fact that labor costs go up in some areas, none of these small areas would ever, let's take from our viewpoint, would ever improve. Whether they actually improve or not, that remains to be seen. It's really redistribution of wealth. So it gradually filters down. And now more of it is going into Mexico and going into South America. It went to Japan first, and it, other places in the Far East, and then Germany started a lot of it here in the United States, and it's gradually spreading out. You can buy German parts that were made for your Volkswagen that were made in Japan. It says Bosch on it, and which is German, but it says made in Japan stamped on it somewhere else. You know, it's all starting to even out, and until it does, there are going to be these pains that go on.
I believe that's an illusion of the capitalist system, the trickle-down theory. I don't believe it happens.
Can we leave this one unsettled and try another area?
This woman wanted to make a comment. Did you want?
No, just following along with these these lines, even though you don't like to talk about international politics, isn't that what got Nestle into problems when we had to boycott, which didn't ultimately work anyway here?
Please, please don't bring up Nestle.
It's the same old, it's the old idea.
Let me ask a question here. When the I just want to ask one simple question. Did Nestle support the World Health Organization proposal for controlling marketing of infant formula in undeveloped countries? Was Nestle in favor of that UN proposal? How many think Nestle was in favor of it?
Yes.
They were. They supported it. Well, I mean, it's...
Nobody votes in the UN really meeting.
I know, but I...
Killed that, yeah, killed Moscow for charging into Afghanistan didn't change.
All I wanted to establish was that the issue, that there's a lot of misinformation about the issue.
Before we get off on a big transnational tangent, I think maybe something relevant to say in general about trying to discuss the global connections of our involvement in large systems is that that is a reality we cannot escape. To say, I wish that we could stay with the simpler, less complex problems, but I think we do live in a in global systems, and we can't deny those connections either.
Well, I don't want to deny the connections. I'm really making a plea for proceeding step by step from the simple to the more complex in our effort to understand.
Okay. Joel, I don't know who was first. Go ahead.
The question that intrigues me is still a question that was asked earlier, and that is, when you're considering an impersonal system and a connected with it of a morality of enlightened self-interest, is that something that we can assume is compatible with what Jesus spoke about and talked about? Is it possible that we can divide that in half? And I've been sitting here mulling over what Jesus did say about those things. In the Gospel of Luke, on at least two occasions, people came to him in their enlightened self-interest, one asking, what must I do to be saved? And he was told the story of the Good Samaritan, and it was a story about how a person rejected by the social system chose to do something that was very unprofitable in taking care of an injured Jew, when other people who were pursuing their own enlightened self-interest obviously knew better than to stop. The other was when one came and asked Jesus, assuming because he was a rabbi that he was a teacher in this impersonal social system, asking to divide his inheritance, his father's inheritance between himself and his brother. Jesus answered by talking about a rich man pursuing enlightened self-interest and ends by calling the man a fool. It seems to me that Jesus is addressing enlightened self-interest and impersonal systems and really is taking upon himself the dismantling of the impersonal system. I think that's something that really has to be dealt with. I really think Jesus addressed that.
Okay,
first,
some people over here.
Back here. Did you want to comment? It doesn't tie into that.
There are a bunch. Well, I think that's a good statement. We just let it stand.
Well, I have a question for Paul then. I'm interested in Washington, more specifically maybe, by the rules of just behavior that's accepted in society, particularly how, if you could compare and contrast those to a face-to-face ethic. So I'm confused by what you mean by the generally accepted
rules. Yeah. I could not explain this briefly. I hope to talk about it on Friday. That's a crummy answer. I think the people of a society, though we can't agree on what the rules of justice are, it's amazing how much we can agree on what is unjust. Because that's not right. That's not fair. And I believe that our laws reflect certain judgments about what's right, what's fair. John Rawls, in his very, very influential Theory of Justice, relies upon this notion that if we all went behind the barn and not knowing where we were, what our positions were going to be in the game that we played, we could agree on just rules of the game. If we say, well, we're going to have to go live our lives, we don't know what positions we're going to have, let's agree on some rules. Rules laid down in advance, binding upon all, that you know, treat people with respect and take care of, take account of fundamental human needs. That's what I'm referring to. I'm really referring back to a whole long tradition that's been resuscitated in the last 10 years.
In what way are those different from the ethics-based society?
Well, they do not require you to minister to the known needs of known persons.
They're not as specific?
They don't. Well, that's right. They're general rules, for one thing. See, I like to contrast the rules of assignment of responsibilities and distribution of rewards in a family with the rules in a large impersonal society. In a family, I think the rules of justice, that's a face-to-face society, are from each according to need, to each according to ability and merit. That cannot work in a large impersonal society. And the proper rule in a large impersonal society, I believe, is something like from each according to preference, to each according to other people's preferences.
Even in your citing of the personal face-to-face values, the question of merit, I do not perceive, to go back to how do we perceive this as Christians, the question of merit is not the basis of how we behave, even on a personal basis, let alone someone who is not an intimate acquaintance.
And we don't, when you say we do not assign goodies to people we know at all on the basis
love
of merit.
Love perfectly, even as your father loves, unconditionally.
But when my children come to me to arbitrate the question of who gets to watch their TV program, I will assign that on the basis of merit sometimes, to some extent. I don't think that's wrong. That's all I mean. You do think I shouldn't. In other words, one child that did not clean her room today, and the other one did. And I'll say, you didn't clean your room, and on that basis, I'm going to let her watch her TV program and not you. There's a decision on the basis of merit, which I think is very inappropriate in a large impersonal society, because no one knows enough to make those kinds. We cannot really assess the merit of other people. We have to go by much more limited criteria. I can't buy my car from a dealer on the basis of merit, or I can't buy my toaster or anything else. I buy on the basis of, do I think it's going to work?
Well, in the parable of the loving father, it's not on the basis of merit that the father throws the feast for the chosen son. Operative within, or part of the teaching of that parable is that your worthiness of a certain reward or a certain kind of treatment is not the basis of your treatment.
That's right. There's a difference between my merit, claiming things for myself on merit, and awarding things to others on the basis of my appraisal of their merit. But I don't want to talk too much. I would like to let some. I'm a doc. I'm not really trying to doc. I want to get other people's views out. Tim, is that okay? Betsy.
This is probably very simple, but you question. I mean, simple of me to ask it. You are describing a capitalism or a system, and full of imperfections, but it's sort of ricocheting or struggling along. And you say it's easier to say, to look at it and say, oh, that's no good, and so forth. And I guess I agree with you. I would like to ask Marilyn, what in a very complex society such as we have, would you suggest as positive change and what one should do? I think it is easier, in a sense, to say, you know, this isn't the way Jesus would do it or so forth. Now, given, I felt like saying this to Will Hausfeld in a way, supposing the blacks were sitting down in Washington, and I'm with them just the way I am with you, but if I can't see that anybody can, just by changing color, or just by walking in there as Christians, can make an enormous change, what do you suggest as a positive thing to replace what Paul is defending?
I don't think that the change will come about by the change of institutions or systems in the intentional sense of legislating change, though I think that that is a part of it, that legislation can reflect a change in values. I think it's basically a question of values and what we see as being more whole for people. I believe that the kingdom of God that Jesus talks about is an alternative way to be social, to be political, and to be personal. I believe that the community of followers of his way of being and living and dying were a foretaste of the humanity to come, and that we being the inheritors of that tradition, we being also the called out from the natural way that society tends to run, that what we are really to be in the world is different, peculiar, and that we can begin by being part of more holistic communities, that we can begin by saying no to systems which we see as being dehumanizing. If we see capitalism as being dehumanizing, not that there's anything better we're going to replace it to, but to give our real allegiance to the kingdom of God and to the way that the kingdom calls us to behave interpersonally. Ultimately, I see a move back towards an agrarian-based economy.
Can I say one short thing? When I was defending capitalism, I was describing a system that also is socialism. Socialism works the same way. This is not. But I wanted to say that there's this community that Marilyn just finished talking about. I would want to stress the importance in my own way of thinking of that too. I think there's face-to-face society, impersonal society, and there's also ecclesia. And one other comment. Sneaking in the last word, that while societies do evolve, as Jim said, I think we should be aware of the fact that they evolve without anyone's control. The social systems are indeed the product of evolution, but it's a kind of an invisible hand process. They're the result of human intentions, but not of human design. And when we begin, our system begins evolving because we're dissatisfied with the values of it, we do not get what we thought we were going to get. That's a very important thing to remember.